Secrets and Spies presents Espresso Martini with Chris Carr and Matt Fulton.
I'll get us running. And now, 3, 2, 1. All right, stand by. And hello, everybody, and welcome to Espresso Martini. Matt, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, Chris. We're very quickly getting into spring here in the Northeast.
Yeah.
How are you?
Good. I'm good. We're finally getting a bit of spring here too. As I speak now, I can see blossom on a tree, which is nice.
We got those.
Yes, it's usually the time of year when London actually smells nice for about 2 weeks. and then I think there's another period later in, is it May, where we have a similar thing where another batch of blossom comes out. I could be wrong there, but I feel like it happens twice a year. I could be wrong there, but I feel like it does. Maybe it's just, I don't know. Maybe it just happens such different times of year that my memory is like, you know.
Anyway, yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? Somebody can tell me. I'm not a is that a botanist being a plant expert? Is that botany?
Yeah, it is. Botanist.
Yeah. So any botanists out there, please feel free to email us and tell us about
blossom. A lot of botanist spies.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember once we talked about one on a past episode about what was it about now? It was about industrial espionage a couple of years ago. There was some sort of English botanist who went to China and was stealing secrets from China for the British.
It's a good cover.
It is.
If you think about it. I mean, it gives you a reason to like travel and be in these exotic places.
Yeah.
You know, and like, it's almost like saying you're like a botanist is almost like saying you're like an accountant. Like no one really follows up with that. It's like, oh, okay. Yeah.
No,
you're a plant guy or gal.
There's a film based on a Frederick Forsyth novel, The Dogs of War, where Christopher Walken's character goes undercover as a botanist, and then he gets quizzed on like the Latin names for certain birds. So if it is your cover, you better know your stuff.
That's a good point. Yeah, you gotta, you have to have some sort of subject knowledge, subject matter knowledge there. Yeah,
because I don't think I'd be very good as a botanist. I could be a photographer. I could totally talk about f stops versus t stops and ND filters and graduated filters and what have you. But anyway,
yeah.
Well, filters and plants aside, on today's episode, we're going to look at President Vladimir Putin exploiting the ISIS-K attack for his war on Ukraine. Then we're going to look at House Republicans holding up US aid to Ukraine. And then we're going to look at new revelations in regards to Havana Syndrome that have come from a new episode of 60 Minutes. So we cover quite a lot of very interesting information on Espresso Martini today. And then we're going to move on to our Patreon-only show, Extra Shot. On that, we're going to look at Chinese disinformation efforts targeting US elections, a Chinese drone flying over the Sea of Japan, and the results of a recent survey in the US that suggests some gun owners may be willing to engage in political violence. And then we wrap up looking at Hollywood's depiction of espionage in film and television. You'll need to be a Patreon subscriber to get access to Extra Shot. Just go to patreon.com/secretsandspies and pick a subscription level that works best for you. And depending on which level you select, you'll get a free cup or coaster. Well, let's go to Moscow and look at the ISIS-K attack. So not the cheeriest of starts, but I'm hoping towards the end it will get cheerier on this podcast. Well, at least it will on Extra Shot, I think. So there we are. So on the 22nd of March, ISIS-K gunmen stormed a concert at the Crocus City Hall in Moscow. They were armed with Kalashnikov-style assault rifles. 145 concert-goers were shot and killed and injured a further 551. So we're talking about a lot of people there. Videos of the attack show the gunmen used indiscriminate violence targeting anyone that moved. And I'll say this now. I saw some of the video and it was really quite disturbing and shocking. I've usually try and avoid watching videos of mass killings, but it was on Twitter and for whatever reason, I was drawn into it and it was appalling. And in fact, one of the weird observations I have is I noticed one of the gunmen was firing so much that the residue of gunpowder in his gun caught fire in the barrel of the gun. So when he was in the lobby going into the concert hall, he had shot so much that I guess he hadn't cleaned the gun properly or they're using bad ammunition, but the barrel caught on fire. It was like, whoa. And some people were like, is that a flamethrower? But no, it turned out to be the residue gunpowder catching on fire. And that does happen, apparently. Wow. Especially if you don't clean your guns. So ISIS-K claimed responsibility for that attack. And to the surprise of few in the West, people wondered, why would ISIS-K attack Russia? Well, ISIS-K see Russia as being complicit in activities that regularly oppose Muslims in the Middle East. And according to Colin Clark from the Soufan Center, ISIS-K has been fixated on Russia for at least 2 years, frequently criticizing Putin in its propaganda. ISIS-K, otherwise known as the Islamic State of Khorasan, is named after an old term for the region that includes Iran, Turkmenistan, and Afghanistan. It emerged in eastern Afghanistan late 2014 and quickly established a reputation for extreme brutality. So very much on the ISIS brand there. ISIS-K has threatened to commit similar attacks in France and the UK. And in fact, there was some ISIS propaganda where they depicted the Emirates Stadium, which is the stadium for Arsenal in London. The US government had warned Russia that a potential attack targeting large gatherings in Moscow is imminent. And this was a warning that Putin dismissed just 3 days before the ISIS attack on the 22nd of March. Putin said that the warnings resembled outright blackmail and an intention to intimidate and destabilize Russian society. The Russian authorities managed to catch the gunman quite quickly after the attack, and then they subjected him to numerous forms of torture, ranging from electrifying the testicles of one suspect and cutting off the ear of another and feeding it to him. And those videos were both posted online via Telegram and Twitter. And I can tell you now they made disturbing viewing because for some stupid reason I decided to watch a man have his ear cut off and made to eat it, which was not pleasant.
You've had a fun couple of days researching this show.
I did. I don't know why I did that, but there we go.
Yeah.
I avoided watching the man with his testicles being electrified.
That's
but
a good
idea. I saw a photograph of mid-electrocution. It did not look pleasant. So it is believed that the Russians are using tried and tested torture techniques to force the gunman to claim links to Ukraine, despite ISIS-K taking responsibility for the attack. And they have taken responsibility quite a few times now because they're quite frustrated with the Russian government as well. And not wishing to waste a terrible atrocity, Putin, immediately after the attack, said that Ukrainians were responsible in working for the West, and his propagandists echoed this. One such propagandist, Sergei Karnikov, who was the host of Solovyov Live, and he said that, "We know that Ukraine is the link between the British and American intelligence services, that Ukraine is a proxy force of American and British military. And does anyone have any doubt who did this? I'm sure Ukraine did this," he said on television. And apparently the US and British motive was to delegitimize Putin by depicting him as unable to protect his people despite a prior warning. Apparently then on that same show, they showed a deep fake clip of Ukraine's top security official, Alexei Danilov, which was designed to show that Ukraine and not ISIS had actually accepted responsibility for the attack. But obviously it was a deepfake video. And shortly after showing that clip, Karnikov admitted that it might have been an old clip, but insisted it doesn't change anything. The head of the FSB, Alexander Bortnikov, said that investigations believe radical Islamists carried out the attack, but that Western special services assisted and Ukrainian special services played a direct role. Bortnikov cited no evidence to support that assertion. So, as I said, Putin doesn't want to waste an atrocity. He would like to, you know, use it to justify further action in Ukraine. So, Matt, what are your thoughts on this terrible attack and obviously on the way Putin's sort of positioning it?
Yeah. Something about how Russian state media appropriated this attack to fit its narrative against Ukraine, like the speed of it, how confident they were about it. It just felt so egregiously dark and nihilistic, you know? I mean, the sort of conspiracy that ISIS is actually like a creation of Western intelligence or Israel or something. I mean, that's old. That's been around for a while.
Very popular certain parts of the Middle East, that theory.
Oh,
well.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you know, that groundwork is kind of there. But I mean, yeah, even for the Russians, even for this moment that we've been in, it was just so fast and it was so total. They didn't really even skip a beat, you know, doing it. Like they've either, I can't decide if they've either, I don't know if you have feelings here. I can't decide if they've either like fully bought their own propaganda or if they're just completely soulless and, you know, here's something that we can use to our benefit and let's just run with it, like before the attack's even over.
Yeah, I think the professionals have just sold their soul. They don't care. I think, you know, it's more people watching it are probably the ones who are in that situation where they're trying to work out whether it's true or not. But I suspect quite a few people deep down know it isn't true. But then saying that, there was a survey just recently where I think a lot of Russians believe Ukraine was responsible. So it's very difficult to really say what people in Russia actually think, isn't it?
Well, if you have like such... Okay, let's compare this to like the US or the UK in this situation, right? Where if you had the reality where the entire news media industry was like Fox or Newsmax or like GB News in the UK or something, and it was like literally illegal to say anything other than what was being said on those networks, right? Yeah. And that's the only information source that we had in the US or in the UK.
Oh, God.
You know, I think people would very easily be in the same position. You know, I mean, I think honestly, what ordinary Russians profess to believe about any kind of particular issue, one, I mean, public polling there is so hard, you know, but it's also, it's illegal for them to say anything else, you know, like the responses that they're given under duress to an extent, but also, I mean, does it really matter what they believe? I mean, it's not like they don't have, they've lost the ability to receive any other information to the contrary, you know? Yeah, so like, of course they do. It's like, it's almost like doing public polling of like North Koreans, you know? Like, what do you expect to hear?
Yeah, it's a funny one. I think there's some cynicism in that polling sometimes, isn't there? And then I think also there's this sort of false sense of hope, because I know, like with particular Russia, I think there's a lot of people in the West who want to believe that Russia don't really back what Putin's doing. And I can't answer either way if they do or they don't. And that's the real issue, isn't it? But I think a lot of people just hold out this hope that, oh yeah, of course the Russians don't believe in Putin's war. But it's difficult to say, really. I think they've had, you know, Putin's been working on his population for 20 years now with all his propaganda. It's going to stick after that period of time. I mean, I think in, sort of communist thinking, I think they reckon it takes 100 years to change the opinions of a population of a country.
Yeah.
So,
absolutely.
So there's definitely some sort of logic behind what they're doing.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. One example that I've referenced a couple times. This was a couple months after the invasion started. It wasn't too long into it at all. I want to say it was that following spring or early summer. There was a video that emerged of a Russian woman in London, like on the street, harassing a Ukrainian woman, like parroting all the conspiracy theories about Ukrainians, like that whole kind of agitprop, right? And I think that Russian woman in London exists in the same information environment as you or I, you know, like she's not a slave to Russian state TV. I mean, she can be, but she has a choice not to be, you know. She could be, she could watch RT and then in the next second switch over to the BBC, you know?
Well, the interesting thing there is her experience is state propaganda. So she's going to assume that any media over here is the same. Cause I've had conversations with people who grew up in communist Poland, and they can't shake the idea that any media is not state run and controlled and trying to manipulate them. And so it leads them down the path. This particular individual I was speaking to, funny enough, was a flat earther from Poland, grew up in communist Poland, and just, you know, basically believed the opposite of everything now because that was her reaction to what she grew up with.
As far as like the condition that the terrorists were in when they were brought into court, I didn't I saw those pictures of them in court. I didn't see, I saw videos of the attack itself. I didn't see any videos of them being tortured. I could have, I just like it was right there. I just chose not to.
You didn't miss anything.
I can imagine, what was going down.
Yeah. And blatantly. Yeah.
Yeah. It's shocking to see, but it was shocking just from like a sheer like brutality standpoint, but as like a tactic, it was honestly less shocking to me. It still gave me pause though.
Very heavy handed. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, the brutality one satiates Russians' need to see these people suffer, which I'd hope we'd be better than that, but okay. I mean, if you got your hands on like the 9/11 hijackers on September 12th and did that to them and put it on TV, the vast majority of people would not have any problem with it at all. You know,
yeah.
I think that fact there speaks more to just human nature rather than anything specific about the Russians. I mean, the difference is that their government would do that. I don't think ours would.
No, at least when, you know, like with the black site stuff that happened with the US government.
You're like, I'd be great.
Such an outroar. Yeah, there was such an outrage about it that they're not allowed to do that. So when, you know, that's the big difference, I think. But yeah.
The difference with that, though, is that was quite a bit removed from, that was a couple years removed from 9/11. And like, I'm talking about like the hijackers.
Totally.
Like if you, yeah.
Yeah.
If you
pulled them out and
somehow managed to get a hold of the hijackers, you know, on September 12th, I think you could do that and get away with it. And maybe we would look back on it and be like, yeah, that's not our finest hour. We shouldn't have done that. That was wrong.
Mm.
But in the moment, I think most people would be totally cheering for it. Just being honest.
Yeah.
This deflects anger towards the Kremlin for failing to disrupt the attack when they were clearly warned.
Yep.
It also, it gives a warning to anyone at home in Russia who opposes Putin or the regime, you know, like the messages, even though you're not ISIS, don't think this scale of violence can't be visited upon you.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's honestly what they were doing there.
Yeah, I agree. I one unfortunate observation I make, and I always feel like I'm a bit of a racist saying this, but I just feel like Russia historically do seem to rely on brute force over tactics.
They do.
And so when what happened, it didn't surprise me. But I had real mixed feelings, actually, because I felt really disgusted by what I was seeing. But at the same time, after seeing the footage of the attack, didn't feel totally sorry for the guys, if you know what I mean. I felt really conflicted.
I don't feel sorry for them. I don't feel sorry. I'm like don't. That's not... No. Yeah, that's not where I'm coming at it at all. I just think it's...
No, exactly. But we should not be, you know, torturing people and doing that to people, because we've got to be better than that. Otherwise, we're as bad as the terrorists, so to speak. So, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. No, it very, very brutal stuff that happened. And it was just so obvious. I mean, they were led in... One of them was led in the court in a wheelchair, I think. And they were just so obviously roughed up. Not even, like, slightly roughed up with a black eye. They looked like they were about to collapse and die. You know, it was
the guy in the wheelchair. Is that the one who was electrocuted?
I believe so.
I'd be in a wheelchair too.
Yeah, there was one guy who had a massive bandage around the head, and he was the one who had his ear force fed to him. The one in the wheelchair, I'm not 100% sure, because I didn't kind of keep track of who was with what was going on.
It was
just so disgusting and horrible. It was like I watched probably like 5 seconds, I think, of each clip, and that was enough. But it was just like, fucking hell. I mean, it reminded me actually of that, was it last year or the year before, when Wagner mercenaries castrated a man in Ukraine? It was on that level.
Oh, right. That's apparently a fairly common
thing
that they do over there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. To emasculate people, I guess. I think it's, yeah.
Well, it's also, it's sort of, you know, this that G word hasn't been thrown around in the conflict nearly as much as it has in another contemporary conflict. But I mean, what the Russians are effecting in Ukraine is absolutely genocide.
Yeah.
And frankly, castrating captured male soldiers is part of that.
Yeah, indeed. Indeed. And the G word doesn't get used much in Ukraine. It's horrible. And like kidnapping children and all that sort of stuff that what they've been doing, it's been appalling.
Yeah. I've said that on here before. I have a very bad feeling that something with those kids and families that they're, you know, shipping out east, I think there's something incredibly dark going on there that we don't know the extent of it still.
Yeah, yeah, they're doing something, and I have suspicions of what it might be, but I'm trying to think of the word for it that will totally sum it up in a single word, and I can't think of it right now. But
we'll just look to history.
Indeed.
You know, yeah. I think it's something along those lines.
Yeah.
You know,
I was reflecting on our chat on the previous episode, because we recorded that just the day before the attack, didn't we? And we were talking about Putin and that infamous 1999 apartment bombing in Russia that was blamed on the Chechens and used to justify a second surge in the Chechen war. I don't believe Russia made this attack happen. I don't believe they staged this attack, and far from it. I think whether they let it happen on purpose, I don't know. I still don't think Russians would be that awful. There may be people out there who believe there are, but I think that gets into kind of like 9/11 truther territory, which is not my cup of tea. And I mean, I drank that tea once and I will not drink it again. But I do wonder, you know, through the way Putin's positioning it, whether he's just trying to use this opportunity to justify some sort of surge that might happen soon in Ukraine, because Ukraine's at this really interesting and delicate point right now, because they're running very low on ammunition, and Russia are now making some progress on to retake territory they took and lost before. And I think Putin's now re-galvanized after his fake election. And so maybe I think Putin's not stupid. I think he knows he needs some sort of public support to back him of what he might do next. But I would not be surprised, and I really hope I'm wrong, but I would not be surprised if we're about to see Russia unleash more hell on Ukraine. I mean, to be fair, they already are. They've been bombing the heck out of Ukraine recently. And I just think it's just going to get worse and worse. And as long as US aid's held up, it's not, you know, it's going to go on longer than it really should. Yeah. So, not good. On the ISIS-K thing, had a few conversations, people were like, why are ISIS attacking Russia? And so many people don't realize how Russia is so integrated in Afghanistan, Syria, and Iran. I would label Iran as a client state of Russia and Syria. And Afghanistan, I think maybe, they've certainly got economic ties with the Taliban now. Whether you could say the Taliban or Afghanistan as a client state of Russia might be a bit big there. I don't think they are at the moment, but
yeah,
maybe
I don't
in
think
time.
That's the extent of it.
No, maybe in time they will be. Because, you know, as we've talked about with Afghanistan, it is full of precious metals and minerals that would be useful. And certainly China and Russia are all over Afghanistan post the American exit. So, you know, that is why. Because ISIS-K are attacking the Taliban, because ISIS-K want to be the dominant power in Afghanistan and rule it in the way they see fit. Because apparently the Taliban are not brutal enough. And, you know, so ISIS-K want to take it one step further. So that's why, you know, ISIS-K were targeting Russia. So we may see more attacks by Islamist groups against Russia now. I don't know. Or maybe Russia torturing the suspects in the way they did was also to send out a message to would-be terrorists of this is the fate that awaits you. You know, I heard stories about when Russia was in Afghanistan in the the late 70s, early 80s, the 79 to 89, that apparently they would castrate terror suspects and feed them their testicles and all sorts of terrible things and send body parts back to relatives in the post. You know, these are stories I've heard. I can't verify them, but they're sort of quite commonly perceived stories of sort of the brutality of Russian forces when they were the occupying power in Afghanistan. And certainly, for all the terrible things America did do in Iraq and Afghanistan, I don't think anybody did anything quite like that. You know, castrating people and stuff. So, I don't know. Yep. It's the Russians just don't mess around. So I think there was some strongman messaging, if you want to put it that way, with their things.
I want to touch on the conspiratorial notion around the attack. You know, that like Ukraine was behind it, or it was a Russian false flag. Really made no sense to me at all, like either option. I mean, like, so like Ukraine wants to destroy Russia's capacity to wage war, right? So they're targeting
factories, refineries, rail yards, etc. I just like machine gunning random civilians at a concert achieves nothing for them. No. Never mind the West reaction if they did, you know?
Yeah, they would lose Western support tomorrow, you know?
Yeah, it would. It would be over.
Yeah, if I felt if Ukraine did start doing things like that, I would get off the Ukraine bus, so to speak.
Yeah.
It's just I Ukraine are not stupid. They know that, and they would never do. I just don't think at least under Zelensky's leadership, they wouldn't do anything stupid like that.
As for the false flag idea, the precedent's there for sure. Like you mentioned, the 1999 apartment building bombings that were sort of given a pretext for the Second Chechen War. I don't know what action Putin would need, and we're several weeks now removed from this attack.
Yeah,
I don't know what action Putin would need to justify as retaliation by framing Ukraine for this. Like, are they going to invade now? Already done that. Will they lob cruise missiles at apartment buildings in Kyiv? They do that all the time.
To do something like this on that scale, you know.
Yeah. I mean, would Putin murder like 150 of his own people if he felt it got him something? Yes, I think he would. I just don't know what doing so in this instance would get him, you know? I mean, don't look to like malevolence to explain an intelligence failure when incompetence works just fine.
Well, this is it. Ultimately, 9 times out of 10, people like Putin are just deeply incompetent. I mean, that's ultimately what he's covering up, is his own incompetence. He got a very, you know, he got a clear warning from the US intelligence services, and he framed it in a way that made it look like there were that the US were trying to destabilize things. A bit like when the Kursk happened, the Americans and the British and NATO said to Putin, when the Kursk sank or went missing, we've got equipment to get people out of submarines, we can help you find this submarine, do you want our help? And he said no. Yeah. And he stayed that way for a very long time, and then eventually, when beyond the fact, when it was clear they were all dead, eventually they got Western support on the QT to help recover the ship and the bodies. So,
yeah.
And a lot of deep sea diving training. But anyway, So it's, I know. I think the problem is the lifeblood of the internet is sensationalism. And it tends to be sensationalism from an alt-right stroke conspiratorial viewpoint. So every time something terrible happens, there's always a whole load of people make their entire living out of just framing it as a conspiracy of some sort. And so it does not surprise me that there are... Well, it's interesting, actually. The conspiracy movement for the ISIS-K attack is sort of... Well, the trutherism of it has sort of died down a bit, I've noticed. The Ukraine bit stays, but the trutherism behind it, where saying Putin did it, seems to have died down a bit. And it's probably because it doesn't serve Russia's interests. And usually they're the ones
also not a right-wing narrative to push it.
No.
You know, like the people who usually push those conspiracy theories have no interest in pushing that conspiracy, so you don't hear about it.
No, if there was something happened in Ukraine and they could blame it on Zelensky, that narrative would carry on constantly.
Right.
So it's, No, there we go. Well, anything else to add to that, or should we move on? Okay. Well, the next one is on point. Really, is about the USA to Ukraine debacle, which is still going on in real time, pretty much, isn't it? So I'll hand this over to you, Matt.
Yes, this is one I've wanted to touch on here for a little bit, and I'll sort of go into why and stuff in a second. But I'm drawing from two articles here on this. One is from the New York Times. The other's from the Guardian. Links for all this stuff will be in the show notes, of course. So, House Speaker Mike Johnson continues to face pressure to advance a Ukrainian aid package amidst the threat of a revolt from the hard right wing of his party that could cost him his job. Johnson plans to address Ukraine funding after the House reconvenes after a recess this week. Hard right Republicans, led by figures like Marjorie Taylor Greene, vehemently oppose additional aid to Ukraine, with Greene threatening to oust Johnson. In an interview, Johnson hinted at potential amendments to the aid package, including loans to Ukraine or redirecting seized assets from Russian oligarchs. Other Republicans, like House Intelligence Committee Chair Mike Turner, are arguing for urgent action, warning of the consequences to Ukrainian morale the longer aid is delayed. Legislative options include a Senate-approved $95 billion package and a smaller $66 billion bill posed in the House, the latter carving out humanitarian aid in favor of military aid only. Democrats prefer the Senate package but currently lack the 218 signatures needed for a discharge petition to bypass Johnson's authority and force the bill to a vote. Johnson needs bipartisan support for any aid package, facing challenges due to hard right opposition and a narrow Republican majority, which I think now is down to like two or three or something like that. It's very close, which has been whittled down to a few after several midterm resignations. Marjorie Taylor Greene's threat of a motion to vacate Speaker Johnson adds to the uncertainty, creating the potential for more chaos in House leadership. Some Democrats have expressed conditional support for Johnson, offering him the votes to save his speakership, while progressives like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez demand legislative concessions. However, even some hard-right Republicans hesitate to oust Johnson due to the risk of a Democratic speaker. As the House reconvenes, Johnson faces a critical decision on whether to risk his speakership on Ukraine funding. So, a couple notes on here, and then I'll hand it over to you, Chris. So, I flagged this story because it's one of those issues that's a domestic story for me and about half of our audience, but an international one for you, Chris, and the other half. It's also the one obstacle for Ukraine getting the military aid it desperately needs. I've also been asked more than once, what's the holdup? So a couple notes on congressional rules that aren't clearly explained in the articles here that I think will help people understand how and why this is happening. So some version of a Ukraine aid bill has always had majority support in Congress. It easily passes Senate. The votes are 100% there to pass it in the House. However, the Speaker's office alone has authority to schedule votes on pending legislation. Then there's the Hastert rule, which says that the Speaker will not schedule a floor vote on any bill that does not have majority support within their party, even if the majority of members of the House would vote to pass it. So it's like the majority of the majority, right? It's an informal principle, not written into any actual rules, and is absolutely anti-democratic, partisan exercise, often applied selectively when politically expedient, but them's the breaks. It's unclear how many Republicans would vote for Ukraine aid on the floor, but I'd give decent odds that it probably won't be the majority of them. A lot, but they'll have a lot of defections too. The bill would likely then only pass with overwhelming Democratic support, and it's this sort of looming partisan embarrassment and the promised, you know, wrath of his hard right flank surely to follow that prevents Johnson from bringing up to a vote. Then I hear you ask, but Matt, isn't there some parliamentary trick to get around him? And to that, I answer, there's this procedure called the discharge petition that would force the Speaker to move a bill out of committee into the floor for a vote if it receives the signatures of a clear majority of the House. So right now, that's 218 members. But that would require several Republicans to openly defy their party leadership. It also just historically rarely succeeds in practice. It's always sort of thrown around as like a magic answer, then it just doesn't work.
Really happens, right?
So for any of my friends overseas who thought, if congressional Democrats and Republicans support this aid, why can't they just get their act together and pass it? There's your explanation. And if after you're still asking, but why can't they just get their act together and pass it? I'm just as frustrated as you. It's infuriating, and we deal with it all the time now. And not just on foreign issues either, but this is our system for better or worse, and here's how it gets abused.
Well, I want to make sure I understand it correctly. So am I right that basically I get the impression that traditional Republicans, should we say of the kind of the Bush ilk, would be more supportive of giving aid to Ukraine, but it tends to be the more MAGA Republicans who are the ones who are kind of opposed to it. Is that right, do you think,
roughly? Yeah, that's true.
As a generalization, because I think
so
the Republican Party appears to be going through a bit of a crisis, doesn't it? Where it's trying to work out, you've got this sort of isolationist MAGA side, and then you've got the kind of the more Bush interventionist side.
Reagan era stuff.
So internally that's become the issue, and then Johnson's sort of the man in the middle. I don't know where Johnson fits on the scale from MAGA to Reagan. Where is he in that scale?
He's I think he's sort of naturally moved with his environment.
Yeah. So he's a bit like Mitch McConnell, a bit of an opportunist and...
That, kind of.
Yeah, yeah. Or is that a bit too generous?
That's not a bad way to look at it.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I don't think it's a one-to-one comparison between the two. Johnson's way more of a sort of a Christian nationalist, frankly. Like, I think he would describe himself as a Christian nationalist. I'm not saying that to, like, insult him. Than Mitch McConnell, but they are sort of I don't know. It's if you look at like the hard right of the side of the caucus and their influence on McConnell to a lesser extent, but Johnson also, it's very much like the tail wagging the dog. You know?
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, and like with the MAGA side of things, you know, is it me? Marjorie Taylor Greene was echoing Russian propaganda the other day, saying the Ukrainian government are attacking Christians and Russia's not doing that. And they seem to be protecting it. And by protecting it, she means protecting Christianity. So she's sort of coming at the Ukraine issue from this weirdly kind of pseudo-Christian kind of position that seems to be, you know, basically in support of Russia. And as we've said before, and I, you know, bore people to death, this probably is. That, you know, we've been saying that Russia's positioning itself and has been for the last 20 years as sort of the savior of the white Christian world, which then seems to intersect with MAGA Republicans, this thing. And I think this is partly, obviously not completely, but partly explains why, should we say, the real diehard MAGA Republicans are opposed to aid. Then you've probably got the opportunist MAGA Republicans who just want to, I don't know, be successful and powerful. And then you've got the Republican stroke, the sort of Reagan stroke Bush Republicans scratching their head trying to work out what the hell's going on, even though they kind of sowed the seeds for this, by the way, they used Christianity during the war on terror. So it's a real damn mess quite a few different things. And sadly, it's costing Ukrainian lives and it's making the Biden administration look a bit feckless internationally. I think
it's totally out of their power. Yeah. You know, like I know Taras Kuzio, hearing your interview with him, very frustrated. And there's a lot of people in Europe who were, it's totally out of his hands.
Yeah, exactly. Because it's not like, because America's not at war itself, the president doesn't really have authority to bypass anything, does he? If America were at war, am I right that there's an executive order he could do? But
like the Defense Production Act and everything. And is that what's the National Defense Production?
Yeah, but that's not on the table.
No, it's not.
And it never would be in this situation because it's supporting it. It's kind of, it has some echoes to what happened during the early days of World War II before America officially came on board.
I have that in my notes.
Yeah, you know.
Yeah.
The America First movement back then were isolationist, a bit pro-Hitler, and against, because of the horrors of World War One and stuff, partly, didn't want America engaged in another, as they saw it, European war. And it has so many echoes there of that.
Well, so, I mean, as you said, said it perfectly, like, we confronted the same hurdle in supplying aid to the UK in those couple of years before Pearl Harbor, and then Pearl Harbor completely changed everything, right? And it's, that non-interventionist streak in our culture that was really prevalent then, and I don't think has been more so now than it has been at any point since then. And the problem is it doesn't sit neatly on either side of the political spectrum, you know? I mean, as you said, like, after World War One, there's a genuine weariness of getting dragged into another major foreign war that seemingly had nothing to do with this. You know, like, you had, like, people said, you know, oh, like, Herr Hitler is a strong leader pulling his people out of depression, and we could use that here. Yeah,
he makes good roads, apparently.
Right. Britain can't possibly win on her own, you know, so why bother supporting her? And, you know, we should sue for peace instead.
Joseph Kennedy was saying stuff like that, wasn't he?
Right. The Germans are the only bulwark left against the godless communist horde from Asia dominating all of Europe. And, you know, a lot of people, like, earnestly, I would say naively, but earnestly believe this, while you had some, like, you know, Charles Lindbergh argued for non-intervention because they were sympathetic to Nazi ideology in a racially segregated America. Like, people forget Jim Crow laws were actually a model for the Nazis.
Yeah.
And they preferred the fascist system to our own. You know, today, Marjorie Taylor Greene opposes U.S. support for Ukraine because Putin's Russia styles itself as a white conservative Christian fundamentalist state. And she wants the U.S. to be one, too. The other similarity to that time, you know, back then as well, some prominent American industrialists believe that Jeffersonian democracy might be nearing its end as a political experiment, but capitalism didn't necessarily need to die with it, you know? So, like, they saw no reason why their businesses couldn't thrive under a far-right autocracy, provided, you know, they remained on the right side of the autocrat. And so they hedged their bets. And, you know, the same thing is happening now with Elon Musk and a host of other tech billionaires feigning concern over nuclear war and calling on Ukraine to negotiate, we know is code for letting Russia take whatever it wants. Now consider that moment in history and how things might be today if the Germans had deep fake AI and social media algorithms to push it all at scale.
Yeah, yeah. I still wonder how we won World War II sometimes.
It's kind of amazing.
When I look into the history of it, because as a kid, it seemed like, you know, quite obvious to everybody that Nazis were bad. But then as you look into it more and more, you realize there was actually a debate.
I think once we started fighting, like after Dunkirk and I'm going to say the Battle of Midway, right? I think it was assured that we were going to eventually win. But for a while there, before the fighting started in earnest there, like in the 30s and even up into the very early 40s, it was not assured at all, the outcome that we got. And actually, it's kind of incredible that we did.
And in the early days of the war, a bit like Ukraine, you know, I think Britain wasn't doing great. Obviously, Dunkirk, major defeat. And I don't mean this as a criticism. I think America and American politicians like winners. And Britain wasn't a winner. And on top of that, the American ambassador at the time, which was Joseph Kennedy, was sending constant cables back to HQ saying, oh, the British are hopeless. Their people are desperate and they're not winners. You know, basically saying they're not winners. And I could be wrong, but I think it was when we bombed the French fleet in Mers el Kabir that things changed. I think that's when Britain was suddenly seen as being really serious about winning this war, where we bombed the French fleet that nearly fell into Nazi hands. I could be wrong, but I think that was a big turning point in the background. And obviously, Roosevelt was always very pro trying to help Britain, but his hands were politically tied. And I think he did a lot to help Britain in many ways that he risked his entire political career on. And you know, I think most of the support didn't really come out publicly until after the war, I think. I could be wrong, but...
Well, there is that, I think it's in... Oh God, what's the Gary Oldman Churchill? Darkest Hour.
Oh yeah, I'm still yet to see that one.
There's a scene in there where he's on the phone with Roosevelt, right? And there's a bunch of like war equipment. I think it's tanks or something. I don't know. Some kind of war equipment that they'd bought from the Americans, right? That Churchill was trying to get delivered into Canada, right? And laws that were passed by non-interventionists in Congress at the time, they could only, like, the Americans, the U.S. couldn't drive it over the border. And, like, Roosevelt says to Churchill, like, well, why, you can bring horses and carriages and put it on there and then bring it back across the border. And it's very clear, Roosevelt wanted to help. Roosevelt was entirely, Roosevelt saw what was going on. It was entirely on the right side of this. But the laws and the people in Congress then, as of now, tie his hands.
So you can see all the parallels of that. I mean, I think we're, especially in Britain, we're very guilty of always constantly comparing things to World War II. But I think definitely this is the clearer comparison in recent history. I don't think you could really compare what happened in 9/11 to World War II and the response to it. But this definitely feels very, you know, very much like a page out of history repeating itself. And the fact that you got an America First movement is just borderline comical.
Literally called the same thing.
Yeah, it's borderline comical. It's,
yeah.
Right, let's take a break. And we'll be right back. Welcome back, everybody. So moving on to, I think, one of the more interesting stories in the last couple of weeks, at least for me, has been some new revelations about Havana syndrome that have come about due to an investigation by Bellingcat, The Insider, and 60 Minutes. And a documentary came out about their sort of findings. And I'll just do my best to very briefly go through, I say briefly, but I'll do my best to kind of quickly cover as much as I can. But I do recommend that you read the article by The Insider that will be in our show notes, because it goes into an awful lot of detail about Havana syndrome. And in fact, I've got some interviews coming up, which will be airing the latter part of next week, if all goes to plan, that might provide some more context to maybe some of the technology and some of the legal side of things. So I'll do my best to cover all this. So the anomalous health instance, also known as Havana syndrome, may have had their origin in the use of directed energy weapons wielded by members of the Russian GRU unit 29155. Members of the Kremlin's infamous military sabotage squad have been placed at the scene of suspected attacks on overseas US government personnel and their family members, leading victims to question what Washington knows about the origins of Havana syndrome and what an appropriate Western response might entail. New evidence suggests that the Russian intelligence services targeted US personnel abroad, and some of those victims have been linked to the building of the US government's covert relationship with the Ukrainian intelligence services in 2014, which we talked about, was it the last episode or the episode before? And I also talked about it a little bit with Dr. Taras Kuzio just last week. And those US personnel and members of their families have fallen victim to the symptoms known as Havana syndrome. And the symptoms include an acute ringing sound, a feeling of fullness in the head, so kind of increased pressure, piercing headaches and vomiting. And in long-term symptoms include memory loss, balance issues, and impaired vision. So one victim in particular who was interviewed in 60 Minutes has lost almost all vision in one of his eyes, which is pretty horrific. And also, apparently, in some instances, the screens of electronic devices, such as smartphones and computer screens, have been damaged when an alleged attack has happened. So that was very interesting, because I'd not heard of that before. And there was a medical study of Havana syndrome by Dr. David A. Relman, and he found evidence of an injury to the auditory and vestibular system of the brain, starting with the inner ear, where humans perceive sound and sense balance and translate those perceptions into electric signals. I hope that makes sense to people. It just about makes sense to me. But and the study found that directed pulse radio frequency energy appears to be the most plausible mechanism, such as a focused microwave beam or acoustic ultrasound. And apparently more than 100 personnel and their family members have these unexplained and persistent symptoms. Lieutenant Colonel Greg Edgreen of the US Army spearheaded an investigation commissioned by the Pentagon, and he believes that Russia is responsible for the attacks. And he noted that the personnel who had been targeted were all considered top caliber officers, you know, kind of the top 5 to 10% performing officers within the intelligence services and their respective agencies. And all of those officers had links to operations involving Russia. And as I said earlier, some of those officers in particular were connected to the early days of Ukraine's covert relationship with the US government. So that was quite an interesting revelation, I felt. And Lieutenant Colonel Edgreen continued that he felt if the US government doesn't deal this head on, things will get worse. And the US government officially has said there's no credible evidence that there have been attacks linked to Russia. So all of that just scratches the surface of a very detailed article by The Insider, which I do recommend you read. Yes, but Matt, incredible. I'm going to hand over to you. What are your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah. You know, you and I discussed offline recently, I think right after this news broke, how kind of odd it is that, like, the assumption right after these cases began was, yeah, it's probably Russian intelligence using a directed energy weapon. And then we went through years of this, like, tortured back and forth, like, we don't know what it is, or it's probably psychosomatic. Mm. And there were even some pretty, I would, when you have your interview later this week, I would like you to sort of bring this up a bit. There were even some pretty unkind, dismissive portrayals of the victims as basically like hypochondriacs, yeah, you know?
I've seen that. Yeah.
Now Occam's razor, it turns out, yeah, it's probably Russian intelligence using a directed energy weapon. Yeah.
I suppose it depends on which brand of Occam's razor you use, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, not any Russian made. Yeah, but like looking at the string of targets presented here, the who, the where, the when. I mean, Russia does seem like an obvious culprit. You know, like so you have Ukraine and Georgia precisely at the moment. CIA stations are staffing up to counter Russian activities there. Havana following the U.S.-Cuban rapprochement. The objectives and the motives are pretty clear, you know, like harass American personnel, high-performing American personnel and their dependents to disrupt operations and make it more difficult for the U.S. to strengthen ties in countries where Russia is fighting to maintain influence and to take revenge against certain officers they hold responsible for the influence they've already lost. Like they say, I know in the 60 Minutes, I don't forget if this came up directly in the article, but it does in the 60 Minutes article, in the 60 Minutes piece that's connected to it. Almost everyone targeted by this thing or affected by it, we'll say, were involved in dealing with the Russians in some way, which I think is very telling. Of the two, and I would love to hear what you think about this part. So in the Insider article, they offer like two possible reasons of why people feel that the intelligence community has withheld all that it knows about Havana syndrome. And they say the first is that releasing the full intelligence around Russian involvement might be so shocking as to convince the American people and their representatives that Moscow has committed an act of war against the United States, or acknowledging that Havana syndrome is caused by a foreign adversary could put a damper on recruitment to the CIA and the State Department. After all, how many Americans would be willing to serve their country overseas in the full knowledge that their next load of laundry or monitoring or morning jaunt to the embassy could result in permanent physical and mental health ailments? That's their quote there.
I've definitely got to push back on the second point. I think what's more of a turnoff is when the American government turned their back on their own personnel who had been injured in the line of duty.
Yeah.
Which is what it feels like at the moment.
Right. Neither reason felt quite complete to me.
I can understand reason one. I think the American government are concerned that, because again, we've had some suspicious murders of Russians in Britain. I think it's about 11 of them that were ruled unexplained deaths or suicides that are now being re-looked at, because at that time, both the Blair government and then the Cameron government, well, the Brown government and the Cameron government were concerned, and this is after 2006 when Litvinenko had been poisoned by polonium, and British relations were at an all-time low with Russia, that they were concerned that the British public might be so outraged by all this that it would force their hand to do something they don't necessarily want to do. And I have a feeling that there is an element of truth to that, because both the Trump administration and the Biden administration kind of played this down. So it's not one or the other, it's both of them have done that. And the only conclusion you can draw from that is there is a level of concern about how this is perceived. There is a third point I would throw in, was it's a bit like Gulf War syndrome, where I think that the American government are probably concerned that they have some sort of, they might get sued by personnel because of a lack of duty of care. Right. And so there might be some sort of legal stroke financial repercussion. Now, again, I could be wrong, but I suspect that could be a factor, but we'll see. But anyway, back to you, Matt. Sorry.
I just think, like, how extensive would a campaign, and this stuff is very serious. I'm not downplaying this at all. It's very 100 serious.
100 people, you know, and it's not just, it's their families too. It's not even just the personnel. It's like the wife or, I don't know if kids have been affected. I could be wrong, but.
Yeah, kids. Yeah. At least they talk about in the 60 Minute piece. But like, how extensive would a campaign of less than lethal attacks, largely directed against U.S. diplomats and intelligence officers, need to be for Americans to demand open war against Russia? I mean, if anything, I think Americans could use a reason to be angry with Russia right now. As for the recruitment concern, I mean, I really don't want this to sound flippant, but I mean, anyone signing up to, and I will clarify this in a second, so hold your pitchforks.
Yeah.
As for the recruitment concern, right? I think anyone signing up to serve overseas must know that they could be like shot, blown up, kidnapped and tortured, beheaded, to say nothing of this stuff, right? If they're not aware of that danger, they should be. And if that risk is a deal breaker, and for many it will be, this isn't the job for them. It's the deliberate targeting of families and the domestic incidents that worry me. I mean, I think like people will accept a great risk of physical harm for themselves. Mm. They won't accept it for their kids.
Listen, and it's happened on US soil, hasn't it?
Outside the White House.
Yeah. And I think there was even an attack in Britain. So usually these sort of things would happen to personnel abroad, like when they're based in Moscow, Vienna, wherever. Vienna's the more glamorous location out of those two. So you kind of like professionally accept there's going to be risk abroad, but there should never be risk in your home soil. And that is a bit of a game changer. And I guess then another thought is, are the government downplaying it just because that they've just not really dealt with it in a particularly great way and they can't guarantee the safety of their own personnel? I don't know. It's a weird one.
I think also, I mean, like the IC shouldn't hide behind classification markings and a need to protect sources and methods as an excuse to deny these people the, you know, the treatment that they need for these injuries.
Yeah.
It's like you mentioned the Gulf War syndrome. It also reminds me of like the lawsuits that were brought against the Air Force in the 90s by two, I think it was security guards at Area 51. And they claim to have worked at the base in the 70s and 80s. And alleged that their sort of like terminal respiratory liver like medical issues were a result of the chemicals that were discarded and burned in these open trenches upwind of the dormitories.
And you had that at the Presidio as well in San Francisco when it closed it down.
I mean, so like these chemicals being burned were likely components of the RAM, so the radar absorbent material that at that time would have been used to coat early operational F-117s and probably B-2 prototypes. And like the exact chemicals in this coating are some of like the most closely guarded secrets that we have. And the Air Force wouldn't help them at all. Like just refused to verify their employment or even acknowledge that Area 51 even existed, right? Like this is the first time that Area 51 even got like serious news coverage was because of these lawsuits. And that to me, like that, just that gaslighting, that like denial of information that could aid their medical care is just so wrong.
It is. These people have served you. It's like, yeah.
Right. Yeah. These guys, I mean, just like these victims, those guys, just like these victims now, like there are people, you know, they were injured serving their country. Like we have a duty to take care of them. And like, you can't tell me there isn't some carve out inside the VA or within the DOD's own health system that can give these people the medical attention they need while protecting state secrets.
Yeah, they could set something up.
I have a strong suspicion that we have a very good idea of specifically how this thing works and like literally what physically is happening to people, you know, when they get hit by it. And we don't really want to reveal that, you know? But like, don't tell me that it can't be done, that you can't find some way to give these people the medical care they need while protecting that stuff that you don't want to get out.
You set up an ultra secret hospital, somewhere ultra secret, where you get unlimited health care to deal with said secret illness.
Yeah.
And that's it. That's all it takes, isn't it? I mean,
the DOD has its own system of hospitals and clinics and all kinds of research, medical research.
Yeah.
Facilities like spanning the globe. Don't tell me you can't find a way to handle this within that.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. Now, that's what puts people off. That's why people get disenchanted with the government, get cynical about government care. And unfortunately, Britain and America do have a bad history. Certainly, the British military has a history sometimes of failing people. And the one thing I have noticed, I could be wrong and things may have improved, but officers tend to get looked after better than the ordinary soldier. I think that's the non-commissioned soldier. I think that's what the terminology for a regular soldier is.
Yeah.
But the, you know, officers tend to get looked after better. And that's wrong. Everybody, if you've served your country, you put your life on the line for your country and already you've accepted that, yeah, you're going to get a pretty crap paycheck. Because again, we have another problem in the UK at the moment. A lot of, I think it's mainly the British Army, it could be RAF too, but a lot of soldiers have very poor living facilities, very poor quality. Some have got terrible black mold and all sorts of things. And that, again,
that's terrible.
It is appalling. They shouldn't, I mean, I'm not saying they should be getting five-star, I mean, it'd be good if you could afford a five-star Ritz experience, but what you could at least do is just make sure places are safe, clean, and, you know, and of an acceptable standard. But that's not the case. And I just don't understand it. And it's just that, there's something gone very wrong when you're not looking after your own people who are serving you. Something has gone terribly wrong there, and I just boggles my mind, especially, like, you know, there's aspects of Britain and American culture that are very militaristic, and, you know, in Britain we have the poppy appeal every year, right. And it always seems to get some people getting very very pro-military, and then you get the kind of people who are a bit more, should we say, far left, who bring up this endless debate of, you know, should we have be supporting the military in this way, and I'm going to wear a white poppy instead of a red poppy. But if you're wearing a red poppy, for God's sake, surely you've got to think that we've got to look after people, you know?
Yeah.
And I just don't understand why we don't. So I share that same sentiment with you, man. It's just boggles my mind. And the gaslighting side of it too is appalling. Because I think you were saying earlier, and I think I've seen it, some victims have just been made out to be liars or hypochondriacs. You know, and if these are the top 5%, 5 to 10% of performers in the US government, if you're treating them like that, again, that's right. Gonna look bad. So I don't know. Very weird. But I'm hoping to learn more about the technology behind it. Because that's the thing because here's the thing about the directed energy weapons. I'm trying to get my head round how you power such a device. In the 60 Minutes documentary, they showed something like a big walkie-talkie. Now, I don't know if that was the directed energy weapon. Now, I thought it was, but when I rewatched the documentary...
Are you talking about that it almost looked like an early 2000s kind of cell phone kind of looking thing?
It was sort of brown.
Was that the thing that they said that he could hit a button and like kill all the GPS data in the car?
That's it. So
that's very cool.
That was, yeah. So I don't know, when I first watched the 60 Minutes documentary, funnily enough, wasn't feeling very well at the time. I just had some terrible food poisoning. So
your ears weren't ringing, were they?
No, I was in a semi-delirious state watching it at like 3 a.m. So very, very meta. So when that sequence came on, I misunderstood because it looked like they'd captured a device, and then it turns out that the device they had captured wasn't the directed energy weapon, but it might be this cool thing that can wipe all electronic data around you. Is it like sending out a small EMP or something? What's it doing?
They didn't explain how it works.
No.
I could look into it. But what they said was. It looked like a sort of like an early 2000s cell phone or like a walkie-talkie or something. And they said it could be used to like sort of clear all the sort of like electronic information in the car. So like your like GPS tracking data and all that kind of stuff. You could just hit a button and all that stuff would just disappear. Yeah, what specifically that is or how it works.
I have no need for something like that, but I'd love something like that.
I'm interested in that.
Yeah, kind of cool. Should get them as a sponsor.
Yeah. Hide your affair with this simple trick.
Yeah. You might need a new car every time, but hey.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, look, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add. I think I've pretty much said that all I'm going to say, I think, on this. But
I'm very interested to hear what you learned from your conversations this coming week. I think that'll be very interesting.
Yeah, I won't say who's coming on because they might change their mind, but fingers crossed that the two guests you've committed so far will... join me and we'll chat about it and hopefully be all better educated on various aspects of this case by the end of it.
I know who they are and they're very good people to have on the show.
Yes, so I'm quite pleased. So, right. Well, I think we will move over to Extra Shot. So, Matt, thank you.
Thank you.
And for those listening out there, thank you very much for joining us today. If you do want to join us in Extra Shot, all you need to do is go to patreon.com/secretsandspies and you can subscribe there. I will include a direct link to the next episode of Extra Shot in the show notes. So all you actually have to do is click on that link. We will be covering Chinese disinformation efforts targeting the US elections, a Chinese drone flying over the Sea of Japan, and a recent survey that suggests some US gun owners might consider engaging in political violence. And then we will wrap up by looking at Hollywood's depiction of espionage in film and television.
Where can people find us online, Chris?
So people can connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, we're on Blue Sky, and Spoutable, and all you have to do is go to those websites and just type in Secrets and Spies, and you'll find us. Even though you might not find us on Twitter, because I think we've been semi-shadow banned on Twitter. Because when you search for us, we don't always come up. But if you go to the bottom of this of the show notes, you can click on a direct link there, and it should take you to our Twitter page and all other pages. Don't forget, we're also on YouTube. So if you like looking at squiggly lines as we speak, you can go to YouTube and see us on there. And that's it, really. So.
And if you don't like looking at squiggly lines, we're gonna work on that in the near future.
Yeah, we're in discussions at the moment about how to sort of adjust things for maybe the next season of the podcast. We might do a few more video interviews and so on. I think why I've been hesitant with video interviews in the past is just the varying quality of people. Because with guests, we have zero control over the setup of a guest. Some guests have really great setups and some don't. And so at least with audio, you can kind of get away with that to some extent. But with video, you know, I'd rather not interview people who look like they're in a, I don't know, a prison cell somewhere.
Black site, yeah.
So we'll probably only air the video of interviews if it looks good. But certainly between us, I think between our setup on Extra Shot, we'll finesse it to a point where we're both happy, and then future Extra Shots, you'll be able to see us. I might have to start wearing a disguise. I don't know. But anyway, maybe just be backlit and change my voice. I don't know. There we go. Well, we're going to go to Extra Shots. So thank you very much, everybody, and take care.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.